The title of the talk today is Clover. The first year that I came here, which was also the first year that Stonehouse existed, every day I found about 20 four-leaf clovers and five-leaf clovers just walking up to the big building and back. And so I would give them away and press them. Over the years, some people who were there have then given seven-leaf clovers that they've come across. And it brings back the feeling of that, the first year I mentioned on the first night that we just finished, one of us, we, someone who's not here now, had just finished painting, just finished stringing up the lights. And so, as I walk over the same clover grass, sometimes my mind remembers, oh, four-leaf clovers. Last year I found a couple by mistake, kind of, not when I was looking for them, and not in the usual place. It was over on the paths that are mowed in that kind of loose meditative labyrinth that you have there to walk on. Past the pond. And this year, it kind of, my mind stumbled on that four-leaf clover memory yesterday. And I thought, let's not just not pick that one up. It's one of those, it could be kind of an annoying thought. And then, of course, on the way from the afternoon meditation home, I just saw, I think, four or five. The lowest number of leaves was five. Five leaf, six leaf, and seven leaf clovers. It almost looks like the way that they're made, the ones that I picked today, that it's now become a new kind of clover. It's not just a one-off. It was like a whole bunch of them all on one plant that were all five, six, and seven leaves. And it feels a little bit like this retreat and Stonehouse that by mistake, by accident, by luck, we ended up doing this crazy thing. So in their case, buying this expensive piece of land and managing to run it and pay the staff and do crazy, wonderful projects here. And now it's what happens here. That's what the Stonehouse is. It's not just a one-off. So it seems like now there is this plant that creates five, six, and seven leaf clovers. So it's like a luck plant. Reliable luck in an ordinary place. And so this is in part continuing that exploration of the question of what is meditation. And especially with the theme of simplicity. I'm often called to the word simplicity and the feeling that I have around the ideas of simplicity. And then I notice that it's actually really hard to pin down what simplicity is. So many times, what we think of as simple is really what is convenient. So not so much simple as convenient. It's more simple, in one definition of simple, it's more simple to just flush the toilet and not have to think about what happens to our excrement and kind of pay water tax to let someone else deal with it. Or is it more simple to deal with that caca? I went with my son to a dinosaur museum a few days ago, and they had a special exhibit on poop. It was called The Scoop on Poop. It was made exactly for him. Poop is a simple subject. Or is it? And what is the simple way of being a pooping creature? So I'd like to bring out this question of when something in us is drawn towards simplicity and something else in us is drawn towards convenience. And if we could be really clear that it's not necessarily the same thing. And there's not a kind of regimen that we should go for one or the other, that we should always go for what's not convenient. But I think we need to bear in mind that if we're not in a mode of care, we will be drawn towards convenience. And then that will seem normal, and we'll be drawn towards more convenience, which after a while ends up being very, very complicated for a lot of people. So just briefly letting your mind have a brainstorm about what simplicity is, if there's any way of knowing or defining it. Is smaller, simpler? Is less electronic, more simple? Is faster, simpler? Is less thinking involved, more simple? And also to really then have a second quick brainstorm about what is convenience. Because I think we even get confused about what's convenient. So many times what's supposed to be convenient ends up eating up our lives. Open Dharma has always relied on email from the very beginning. We were born with the beginning of email. And I don't know how we would do what we do without it. So I'm not saying like that I'm anti-technology at all. But it is good to sometimes feel how convenient it is to have a computer in the house. Or how inconvenient. And just to give yourself a chance to look over a day and notice if it's convenient or inconvenient that there's a computer available. And then if we can get gradually a really good feel for the difference between the movement towards simplicity and the feeling of the movement towards convenience. Usually we don't notice much the movement towards convenience. It's normalized and it's quick. Sometimes it's just the right medicine. It's really important sometimes that there be convenience. But if we have a really good sense of what we're driving, if we have a really good sense of what the brake is and what the gas is, and what the gears feel like, if we have a really good sense of what the movement to convenience feels like, what the movement towards what I'm calling simplicity for now feels like, it could help us feel better when it's good medicine and when it's poison. When it's good luck that you happen to be born into a country where air conditioning is normal for maybe the majority of the people. Is that true? Probably. Not everybody. (Clears throat) And then we're able to just very, very gently, honestly, and simply feel the cost of our conveniences to not only ourselves but others. And that can happen gently, sometimes inconveniently, gradually, very organically, in a way that it's not at all about guilt, but about aliveness and luck. There's a way that we are sensitive to one another, near and far, that we need to take into account for our sanity and our meditation. And if there are days where you feel like you can't find your sanity and you don't know why because you have everything you need, it could be a time to let that organic stretching out of actually feeling our sensitivity, our mutual influence on each other, near and far. To feel the support, to feel what you're kind of giving off, so to say, and what you're receiving near and far. What you're more consciously receptive to, and what you're letting in the back door while you're guarding the front door. There's a concept, I guess it's from mathematics, it's so long ago that it's hard to remember, but lowest common denominator and highest common denominator. There's a way that we can influence each other and we end up falling into the lowest common denominator. I realize only now that I'm not even sure what it means in math anymore. That's really frightening. I think maybe it means, I'm going to guess and then someone tell me, I assume someone knows. Maybe like 81 is divided by 9 and 3. Am I going the right direction? And so is 72 divided by 9 and 3? No? Okay, so what's the lowest common denominator?
Anybody? The lowest number that will go into the big number?
That's what I mean. So I'm going down. If you have all these bigger numbers and you can divide them by 9 and 3, 3 would be the lowest common denominator. Okay.
One.
And 1 would be, oh, always. Good, the lowest common. So I think I might have invented highest common denominator. Did I? Good. It's like the 7-leaf clover. It's not supposed to exist. Maybe if you have 81 and 72, the highest common denominator would be 9 or something. So anyway, the math is not important. It's just funny. When we're not tuned in to how sensitive we are and how much we're receiving and giving, how much exchange is going on near and far, the most likely thing that happens, the usual thing that happens, is the lowest common denominator, in the sense of, let's say, gossip, in the sense of projection, in the sense of, well, everyone else is eating hamburgers, so. So I know a lot of people who, I'm not like an activist in any way, but I have just so happened to have been vegetarian since I was 18. And I have a lot of friends that I know from India, and then when they spend a few years in the West, anywhere, any country, after a few years, they start to call fish vegetables. Often the Chinese medicine person is the one who told them that they need it, because in China you eat everything. So, it's not a good example because it might make you feel bad if you eat, or it might make you feel that I disagree with you or something. I don't at all mind if you eat meat. It's up to you to find what's good for you. But someone who might wish they were vegetarian ends up eating animals because that's what people are doing here. Or more commonly, we start speaking about negativity in a negative way because that's what everyone's doing. And we start kind of categorizing people the way that would happen in a village where there's the village idiot and so on. Forgetting the power of one word. All that I say applies outwardly and inwardly, I hope. That's my intention. So there's also the kind of zoo of our minds and the lowest common denominator of our habits. And because we've let a habit hold sway a few times, it ends up feeling normal again. And our whole attention and energy is drawn into that downward spiral of that lowest common denominator of maybe self-hatred or fear, insecurity, etc. And just like with the math, there's no real reality. There's no real external necessity for that. There's no reason that we have to be drawn into the habit. There's the likelihood that we will if we're not paying attention. But there's no actual external need or landscape that's forcing us to fall into the habit. It's just that our being caught up in that habit draws our attention away. That is basically the habit, that our habit is drawn, our energy and our attention is drawn to what we're used to and drawn away from our possibility, the highest common denominator. So in 81, there are a lot of nines and there are even more threes, but it's not particularly necessary to see 81 that way. We could see 81 in so many other ways. And every once in a while, it might be really important to chop 81 into nine nines or whatever. So every once in a while, that habit that you have of getting confirmation from outside or pretending to be someone that you're not, every once in a while, that might be really important. But when we kind of start to live as if it's our lifeblood, we're actually missing the 81. We're not actually living our lives. So this possibility, inwardly and outwardly, of tapping into the higher common denominator. So just like Susan pointed out, there's the lowest common denominator is one, always. The highest would be the number itself. So there would be the situation itself, always, that we could actually tune into instead of what's going on, why is this happening, who did that, why am I getting behind, etc. Like, what's the actual situation here? Not what I think I am, but what actually am I? What is 81? And it, in a way, should be a shock when that question comes to you and to me. A shock that we don't know what we are and that it doesn't add up. The things that we've been counting and trying to hold together don't add up to what is. So the possibility in any situation, including a difficult situation, and especially to bring our care to a delicious situation, not waiting to respond with all of us for when there's trouble, but to be ready to respond with all of us when it's delicious. Inside us, even when we seem to be in hell, and even when we seem to be completely complete, the possibility that there's still a kind of tide that we could follow, that that we could let lead us, a kind of tide of harmonizing that's bringing out the best in the situation, including the situation of me, of meanness, oneself. And again, as I always like to emphasize, this chance that we have as human beings not to wait to respond to when it's already really terrible and essentially too late, really, except to learn for next time. But when things are okay, fine, boring, or really good, the possibility of letting all of us respond, which means letting all of us rest, letting all of us be in it. Even if I don't yet know what I am. There's a lovely quotation by Auden that I've carried with me for more years than I can count, at least 10. He says, "I know nothing except what everyone knows. If there, when grace dances, I shall dance." And he made grace with a capital G. I know nothing except what everyone knows. I think it's nice that he's bringing out the highest common denominator by assuming that we all know this. And maybe with him we could be happy knowing nothing, nothing else. I know nothing except what everyone knows. If there, when grace dances, I shall dance. It's a bigger statement than it may sound like. To have a certainty that I shall dance, if there, when grace dances. And maybe that certainty that I shall dance when grace dances, if there, can come by all of that letting go, being ready to not know anything except the readiness to dance. Whether it looks like a party or not. Whether the mind is going crazy with insecurity or arrogance or whatever its game is of the day or not. We're so worried many times that we're not ready to not know anything else except that we shall dance. To be ready to kind of take the challenge, which is a long-term challenge, of gradually developing the ability to sense this harmonizing tide that can take us. If we let it. I love in the I Ching, which is called the Book of Changes, that's the translation of it. It's usually used for divination, to ask, shall I marry so-and-so or not, or whatever. But it's also a book about human life. And there's one picture, it's different pictures of human life. And one of the pictures is when everything is perfect and we did the really hard, really careful work of helping to bring the whole world out of trouble into completion. And the danger is that we just stop there. The most normal next picture would be called stagnation. From after completion, the most normal thing to come next is stagnation. But to be ready to dance when grace dances, if we're there, means even when we already did everything and it's perfect, the only way out is to give it all away. the only way for that kind of grace to keep on dancing, instead of things just falling into standstill where what's low is low, what's high is high, and they're not in communication. That's the picture of standstill. What this means in a practical level that you can play with in these days is when a suggestion comes internally or externally, that happens by coincidence sometimes. And somewhere you resonate with the suggestion, there's a chord struck. But so briefly, before the censorship takes over and the idea of going on a walk when I'm supposed to be in the hall, for example, is negated, and we go to the hall instead of on the walk. We couldn't find enough reasons. We couldn't find enough threes to stack up to get to 81, and we didn't just take 81 as it was. When that happens many, many times, and we start to sometimes go on a walk, or sometimes notice stagnation happened, maybe that's an encouragement to receive the suggestion more gracefully next time. It might be go to the hall instead of on the walk. You never know. But anyway, one practical, simple suggestion of how to play with starting to get the feeling for this harmonizing tide that we can always step into. We can always let go into. A harmonizing tide that helps bring us into the highest common denominator mode of experience instead of the lowest. Is just to receive those inner suggestions, outer suggestions, the ones that hit the chord and then you immediately paper over, to follow through on them more often and as soon as possible. Sometimes we're late and it's not too late. Sometimes we got the suggestion yesterday and we do it today and we get the feeling. And sometimes it's too late. Next suggestion. So knowing nothing except what everyone knows. Knowing nothing. So not knowing that I should be in the hall when it says on the schedule to be in the hall. Not knowing that I should be out of the hall when it says to be in the hall. Not knowing anything except that there is in a human being a readiness to experience grace dancing in our presence and to dance. On the way to dancing, sometimes we need to make some rules to help us get the hang of things, to kind of help us more often go across the grain of our habits. But if we could really steadily and firmly know that the rules and the systems are not it, the rules and the systems will be harmful if we apply them for too long, too many times. There will not be any dancing if everyone's just following the rules. There won't be the chance to receive life's unpredictability as a way to feel how big we are. And again, it's interesting that many times the rules and systems come into place in response to problems. So when Gautama Buddha was alive, and during his lifetime, more and more people were wanting to follow his teachings. And then he had teachers that he appointed to help teach some of those people, and then they had bigger and bigger groups. And as the years went by, of course, there were problems and friction. And sometimes within the group of monks and nuns, and sometimes between the group of monks and nuns and the people that they depended on completely for their survival in the way of food and places to stay in the rain and medicine and clothing. So in a really basic way. We kind of theoretically imagine that we depend on other people to live. We don't really have that strong gut sense that we do, even though we do. We don't survive without each other. So they had a lifestyle that reminded them of that every day. They would go and ask for food, and they would take whatever came, including if it were would be a dead animal. They were not vegetarian, since I mentioned that. If you eat animals, you're in good company. So there were some people who believed that plants and trees were more alive than some of us may think. So they had spirits in them, and sometimes very important or powerful spirits. And so it would not be good to spit on those plants. It would be disrespectful to spit on those bushes and trees. And so then there must have been a problem. You can kind of read the, it's like reading the newspaper of how the Sangha life developed, how the group of monks and nuns life went, because why would there be a rule not to spit on a plant if it hadn't happened and someone got upset? And they said, okay, so nobody spit on the plants. I think that this points us to our human possibility of living with the reality of rules without letting them be kind of God. And with a kind of challenge of, can we keep that leading edge, the harmonizing edge, so precisely and so lively that there's not so much need to make more bad news and more new rules. So we might feel like spitting, and something tells us, don't spit here. And we think, well, I just gotta spit. Who cares where I spit? And then it becomes bad news for yourself and others. So the inner suggestions, we can get more and more flexible in the not knowing anything except what everyone knows. So it's important to notice what your rules are. What are the rules that you abide by, if any? And kind of feeling into the roots of them, where they got formed, which sometimes is childhood punishment. You would never speak out in a group because when you were a child you did and something terrible happened, and therefore if anyone speaks out in a group they're in danger, kind of experience. And really looking to replace the rules that you live by and the systems that you live by with kind of more living guiding principles that help steady you in your growthful process of being able to feel that harmonizing tide. So that after a while, less and less of even a guiding principle, and more of this very alive leading tide. When we know that we know nothing except what everyone knows, there's more room for us to get to know what we need to know about ourselves, especially our blind spots. And it also opens the way to know anything we need to know in a different way, a different kind of knowing. So to start with, I have a line from a poem called the Sinsen Ming, which is a poetry from the third Zen patriarch, so the third recognized Zen leader, about trust. It's usually translated as Verses on Faith Mind. And it's a poem that I come back to several times a year. And we did some of this poem one time in a long distance talk with some people in the local Sangha here, the local meditating group here. And every time there are different lines that stand out for me. Today, one of the ones that I really love is When in Harmony with the Nature of Things. It's the kind of poem that you could almost find a whole world in almost every word. Even the word when in harmony, when in harmony with the nature of things. I'll finish the line and we'll go back. When in harmony with the nature of things, your own fundamental nature, you will walk freely and undisturbed. When in harmony with the nature of things. He's suggesting that there is a nature of things. And it might not be the nature of things like clover is supposed to have three leaves. It might be a different kind of nature of things. So something that is not contrived, not created by us, something that already is, something that maybe is deeper, more mysterious, more powerful than how we know ourselves from day to day, most of us. And then he just simply makes a comma, the English translation anyway, between the nature of things, comma, your own fundamental nature. So there's only a comma separating them, which means there's not a separation. The nature of things and your own fundamental nature. And just that, your own fundamental nature being right next to the nature of things. Something that you don't have to make up. Something that might be hard to find if you're busy making things up. And then there's the possibility of being in harmony with the nature of things, your own fundamental nature. So there's the nature of things going on, available, happening, whatever. And there's our own fundamental nature also, equally the same, available, going on, happening, or whatever it does. When in harmony. So there's the chance that we can sometimes be in harmony with the nature of things and with your own fundamental nature. And even this Zen patriarch is saying when in harmony. He's not saying once you get into harmony with the nature of things, then you're done. He says when in harmony with the nature of things, your own fundamental nature. So I think it gives us access to catch that breeze, even in memory, to remember that feeling of walking freely and undisturbed in a world where there is non-freedom and there is disturbance. Walking freely and undisturbed. I think we can kind of open our sail and catch that breeze, even if it's in a past memory. When in harmony with our own fundamental nature, with your own fundamental nature. You may do things you don't recognize as you in walking freely and undisturbed. You may actually go actively against some things that you think of as fundamentally you, So I'm kind of encouraging a willingness to betray yourself. Not your fundamental nature, but your ideas of what you think you are. Exactly in not abandoning yourself, in not leaving out anything. But also not believing that any one thing, any one aspect of your experience is the whole story or the end of a story. Can you get the feeling from that line from Auden, "I know nothing except what everyone knows. If there, when grace dances, I shall dance." About a different kind of knowing. Kind of being fed up with all the knowing up here about right and wrong, about freedom and disturbance, about nature, about yourself. And to just so wholeheartedly know nothing except what everyone knows. Where does that bring you? If everyone knows it, it's really nothing special. And there's the patience and especially the readiness. So not patience like putting the computer to sleep, patience. Another kind of patience, which is another kind of knowing. A readiness. A responsiveness that's not tiring. It's part of our fundamental nature. Not the kind of responsibility and not the kind of reactivity that we usually put on. But being, like, befriending that part in us, the deep, mostly wordless part of us, that will dance when grace dances, if there, whether we want to or not. We can put on the brake in that case. It's not going to work. And even if we hate that part of ourselves sometimes, there's a way that we know that it's what our life is about. And what else can allow us to kind of be nothing and be with nothingness or nothing in readiness as a relief rather than as a burden? So we talked about this word simplicity. And we do need to kind of go through our closet. You know how people talk about getting rid of clutter, and you go through your closet, and if there's something in there you haven't worn for 2 years, you should give it away. So I think it's even more important to go through the closet of ideas about meditation and ideas about what we are. And I don't necessarily agree that if you haven't worn it in 2 years, give it away. Maybe. But if your inner suggestion says keep that vulture costume that my mother made for me when I was 5. It's gotten a lot of use over the years, but I don't use it every 2 years. But there are a lot of stuff in the closet that you use every day that would be really good to give away. So we almost could, if we're gonna need a rule to get started, then throw the rule away as well. We can use the opposite principle. The ideas about meditation that are dead wood that you use every day, think about how else they could be used, like a dead wood sculpture or a house for someone who needs a house or whatever. And even if it is a struggle to let go of thoughts and ideas, and it's a skill that we can learn, is actually something we can learn to do by practicing. But it's also something that comes naturally. And so it's partly having enough skillfulness that we fall into the natural yumminess of letting go of what's not needed, so that then it starts to happen without the intention to make it happen. That's really important. It's fun even when we do it on purpose, but life just opens up way much more when it happens by itself. That the idea starts to come over your meditation like a shadow, and then it just naturally falls away as unnecessary. It's now very much well known around the world. It gets to be more and more popular still, the mindfulness-based stress reduction. So it's interesting to kind of hear that common phrase again, to realize that mindfulness-based stress reduction reduces stress to feel your knee. It reduces stress to hear the sound of the fan, or the person next to you sleeping, or whatever. It's a relief to let go of unnecessary thinking. It's a relief to let go of the compulsion to be busy in past and future, and to meanwhile miss your 81. And we can really play with that in the moment to moment without kind of stressful pressure, but really play with the possibility of feeling the letting go of a whole big train of thought as a relief. The letting go of an idea about yourself, once you capture that that's just an idea about myself. It's just a 3, it's not the 81. And then to let it go can be really hard. But is possible. And when we start to get the hang of the relief, that living with that much lightness is possible, that we survive, and that there's more room for good ideas as well as no ideas. That also gives us momentum as we just start to have the relief and the luxury of more often receiving color, sound, texture, weight, temperature, etc., just as it is, which means as much just as it is possible in the moment. It might be that you receive the color red just as it is, but you don't like red. So let it be. You receive the fact of red and not liking red, some contraction in the chest, whatever. And then there's the orange that you love, receiving orange and the reaction to the orange, the openness in the chest or whatever. It gives us momentum also then to go really deeply into one or two things that call us. It's interesting that in the words of Gautam Buddha, what we need for our steps toward deep meditation is the right amount of concentration. It's not just like as much concentration as you can get. It's not too much, not too little concentration. And it might seem strange because most of us have a really distracted mind, but there are people who actually have the obstacle of too much concentration, and it stops them from going deeper in meditation. Sometimes it happens because of trauma, and so then the mind has gone to be able to fixate on something to get away from what's difficult. And sometimes it's just because the person has an effective willpower, and the kind of system or consciousness is obedient to that willpower. There's a lot of joy in concentration. That's another reason that it can be an obstacle. But it could be something to feel for if you have a more distracted mind. That in the relief of letting go of that thought again and receiving orange, and the reaction to orange. Again. In that relief, starting to get a whiff of joy and letting that start to be the beginning of a new kind of movement with freshness instead of the repetitive rules, systems, and the regular distracted thinking, habit energy. So just being aware of the power of going deeply into one thing. For some people, it's just the breath. For some people, it's the question of what is this? What is the nature of things? For other people, it could be a mantra. It could be so many different ways of going deeply into one thing. Partly to have the chance to let go and let go and let go, to have relief from the lowest common denominator. And then to kind of catch the wind in the sails, where we start to catch the wind of the highest common denominator in a situation, inner or outer, where we walk freely and undisturbed, and we might do unexpected things, and we might not do what's expected. So we're free from expectation, free from the pressure of expectation. But just as with human science, going really deeply into one thing, like the atom or the nucleus of the atom, has potential for healing, like it's used for cancer treatment, and it has obviously potential for destruction with bombs and energy. If we're just going really deeply into something with our own willpower, or based on a certain rule or a certain logic, if we're going really deeply into something for a reason, if we could know that we're in danger. And sometimes we might want to back up, we might want to have a kind of safety net of people, conversations with people who have experience, etc. And start to feel for, it would be kind of like changing gears, but it's like changing from one kind of gear to a completely different kind of gear. If we could have different species of gears in the same vehicle. Feeling for a willingness to go deeply somewhere, into a question, into a sensation, into a place in the body, into an energy field or whatever. Not for a reason. So when I was looking for the four-leaf clovers, because I took it as a sign of grace, because the first year it was a sign of grace, and the second year there just weren't so many four-leaf clovers in my field of vision. They might have been there, but it might have been because I was looking for them as a sign of grace. And there was no need for signs of grace. And so there weren't. So feeling for the possibility of being completely moved and not just kind of testing again with a few fingers. Testing and testing again is good when we know that we have our human regular logic and our human regular willpower motivating and moving us. It's probably good to test many, many times. But if we're just testing and not also feeling for another way of being moved, then we're going to waste our lives. I was going to say years, but basically. We could go on for decades like that to no avail. if we can do our best, most honest experiments and tests based on what we seem to think is important, and at the same time be open to that readiness in us to dance when grace is there. The readiness to be out of character. The readiness to be taken deeply, like as if inside an atom, inside the nucleus of the atom, inside the, I don't even remember, nucleotides or whatever's inside that. When you try to stop activity to achieve quietude, your very effort fills you with activity. When no discriminating attachment arises, the old mind ceases to exist. If not comparing, not attached to better and worse, you will not fall into judgment and opinion. Do not seek for the truth, only cease to cherish opinions. A few more of my favorite golden threads from the Sinsen Ming. I love when a human being has put into words for us something that challenges us, like a sail that's really caught the wind and shows us how big we are. That we can be in harmony with the nature of things, and that's equal to being in harmony with our fundamental nature. So feeling for what moves us by surprise, what moves us unexpectedly, what moves us out of character. And starting to be ready to give our full attention to nothing. So we can start by giving our full attention to something, something that we love, something that's important. We can start giving our whole life to that. And the more we do that, the more we realize that whatever we're giving our life to is not a thing. It's much more of a no thing than a thing. There might be expectations around that thing, if it's justice or meditation. There may be expectations and images, ideas, memories, etc. But what we love about the thing is not that. What we love about meditation or justice or whatever it calls you is not our expectations about it. It's not our memories about it. It's not what everyone else is saying about it. So the human vehicle is different from the ones we've created, because when we come out of gear and we're in neutral is when we fly, when we come into contact with what we are, with what is our fundamental nature. It's not just coasting on past momentum, it's something else that happens. So practicing the stress relief of just being a body that knows nothing except what everyone knows, and just being a mind that knows nothing except what everyone knows, So mindfulness just means being so fully with what is present in the body or the mind that there's not room for another drop in the barrel. That's the Buddha's image. We're completely fully, so not just like full of old ideas, but we're so fully present with any aspect of our present experience that there's not room for the old stuff. The burdensome practice of judging, in the words of the Sensen Ming. The burdensome practice of judging brings annoyance and weariness. I love that line. So it's not just us. It's been going on for thousands of years. Getting the feeling of that relief of letting go of ideas. Getting the feeling of going deeply with care for a reason, and feeling for what pulls us deeply for no reason. Remembering where we feel called to go deeply, to give our lives, is not just about what we know of it so far. We might be aware of 10% or less of why we feel drawn to meditation or justice or teaching or whatever, education. Knowing nothing except what everyone knows. Feeling for what are the rules that you could give away, take out of your closet, and what are your more fundamental guiding principles that are less constructed, less fragile, less reactive, less rigid and authoritarian. And what happens when we are more often available and present with what's happening in the body and the mind? So thinking is just a thought, and then another thought. It's nothing more exciting than that. And feeling the heartbeat is just feeling of pressure and expansiveness, pressure and expansiveness. But what is it that seems to sometimes guide us to be aware of a particular aspect of our present experience rather than another? So in the practice of mindfulness, sometimes we're aware of the thought, sometimes we're aware of the body, sometimes we're aware of the heat because it's hot, but sometimes we're aware of the heat when it's not hot. Who decides that? So being aware of the kind of these background, the background guidance. And when is it coming from a reaction, a reactivity, and when is it coming from somewhere else? And then the practice, finally, of paying attention to nothing. Being open. Quiet and calm. Fully alive and fully given to nothing. What happens there. Are there any questions? So let's just have a few moments sweating together. Moments. giving up the hard work of separating from this ordinary aliveness that is enough in itself. May all beings be happy. May our energy and willingness to be here contribute to a momentum towards liberation everywhere.